You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 553 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Mr. Seth Miller. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
You know, it's a rainy day here. It's the beginning of fall for us, so okay. Kind of feels good.
We could use some of that over here if you want to send it.
Yes.
Dude, we haven't had any like all summer. This is like the first real rain we've gotten. So
yeah, we had like one or two big storms, but we're serious droughtage right now. So
really?
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean for like the winter? Just you're hoping for more? Like it kind of is like year.
I mean, what you hope for is the snow, because the snowpack is what we need for, you know, useful things like growing crops and irrigation and whatever. But yeah, we're mostly what you hope for at this point is no one has a bonfire in the fall and actually accidentally sets the whole town on fire.
Yeah, that's kind of that's where we're at. It's like, please don't burn anything ever outside.
Yeah.
And
as an added bonus, my direct next door neighbor, whose fire pit is like 8 feet from my backyard, likes to throw random large things in there that definitely shouldn't be burned, and mostly pays attention to the fire burn rules, but or bans. But yeah, good times. A mattress went up in flames the other day.
Oh God.
Yeah. Also, as Linnea says, all sorts of special cancers coming.
Well, did you read about that guy that like went in for surgery for like, I think it was like lung cancer, and they pulled out a little miniature traffic cone that he had accidentally swallowed like 40 years ago?
No, but
so, you know, cancer comes in all kinds of forms. Sometimes it's a little orange cone. So anyway. Seth, he kind of just ruined Seth's day. He's rubbed his face.
I'm done. All right. Thanks. Been a great episode. Talk to you next week.
So British Airways has announced they're making some cuts to Club Europe, which is their intra-European business class cabin, okay. Specifically the meals. And their reasoning is because the product is so popular and we can't serve everybody. So it's like on really short routes. They used to serve like a full hot breakfast.
Okay.
It'd be like, you know, a full English. And now it's going to be yogurt, I think, maybe a croissant and something else small.
It's the difference that they no longer have to heat it, so you save the time of the oven, because that seems like something you would just hit go as you're taxiing out. And
when you get to 10,000 feet, you start serving it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's.
Yeah. It's still a little hotter and like slower because you need hot hands. I don't know, but whatever.
I think, and for Club Europe, right, they like can make that cabin bigger or smaller based on the demand.
Right.
That's how that one works. So they can, on the Airbus fleet, they just kind of move a curtain and business class becomes 30 people instead of 20 people.
Yeah.
And there's been some comments that people are like really disappointed in this. And I get what BA's saying, but do you mean it's so popular that that's what you're doing? I'll go figure it out.
Is the problem that like they're selling so many club seats?
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Like they're just, it's not that it's so many people are, you know, that 80% of people are, it moved from 50% to 80% of people eating breakfast. It's that there's more seats on board.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. That's the justification.
Cabin shifted to be more premium. That's, I mean, good problem to have. I laugh a little bit because I still remember, and I don't know if they do it now, but like easily late, early teens, 2012, 2013, something like that, doing a Frankfurt Munich business class trip. It was like right after one of the first Star Mega Do's, because we had a Mod Do in Munich that week, and a bunch of us were in business class, and like watching the Lufthansa staff sling dishes, sling plates out of sling beers that quickly, it was pretty incredible. But that was one where they knew it was going to be an issue. This, I think it was like a 321 in the whole A zone plus a few past that, which is all business class.
Yeah.
And they served a ton of meals very quickly, but they staffed for it. They had extra flight attendants on board. And so, you know, my answer, and of course, if you're constantly shifting and you can't be consistent about that cabin size, then overstaffing costs a lot of money.
Yep.
But I do laugh a little bit in light of our conversation last week about Kirby basically saying, we're going to keep investing in the product. You know, it's worth it. We know we make more money this way, even though we can't prove it. This is one of those things that, you know, is, you know, British Airways cutting this. On one hand, it probably makes, you know, sense in the spreadsheet, but does it make sense more broadly? And airlines go back and forth on this all the time, right? Meals at mealtime.
Yeah. Well, and for a business class product, you know, especially Club Europe or anything intra-European where it's not a real business class. It's a coach seat with the block middle.
Yeah.
You're paying for that block middle and a meal, really, in that ticket price. And a check.
And lounge access. Don't forget the lounge.
And lounge access. Good point.
You should eat in a lounge, Stephen.
I should.
I like that you rolled your eyes at me there. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, to that point, though, I mean, this is kind of like the cyclical this thing that we go through in the airline industry and travel. Everything becomes premium, and then nothing is premium, and then we go back to premium. It feels like, okay, it's the same excuse with lounges. Oh, well, the lounges are so popular that, you know, we've got to downgrade service in the lounges to make more room for more seats. No, the lounge is popular because you're selling credit cards and people want to use the lounge with their credit card fee.
Certainly on the US side of things. Europe's a little different, but yeah.
Europe's a little different. But I'm just saying in general, it feels kind of like that's what the whole industry is doing. It's not just BA.
And I will say one of the other headlines that crossed this week, SAS, speaking of lounges, is because they're switching from SAS Plus to business for call stuff, they're also now adding lounge access for all those passengers as well. So I want to say it's like 30 airports across Europe by the end of the year should have contracts in place.
Wow.
So, I mean, and most of it is just contract lounges. It's nothing, nothing that they're doing directly. 35 that they're doing. First one, partner lounges on October 1st will be Nice, Malaga, Palma, Lisbon, Venice, Florence, Naples, Malta, Madrid, Milan, Manchester, Edinburgh, Prague, Krakow, and Keflavik.
Wow.
Or that's where work is underway. It's hard to tell from the sequencing which will be when, but
these contract lounges, I mean, they're good, right? I mean, it's a good thing to have.
It's a nice option to have. Whether the lounge is good or not, I think, is debatable in some cases. But
fair. Yeah.
I don't remember and I haven't been there in a long time, but I don't remember, for example, the lounge at Aalborg being particularly.
There's like a contract lounge in, I think it's Prague that
United
was using. Or Star Alliance was using, and it's not good.
I think I remember that one, but yeah.
All the windows are like way up high, and it's like bright green seats everywhere, like neon green seats. It does something, and it's like I think there's like a smoking section, in it, or maybe there was. Anyway,
excellent.
Yes, for the real European experience. So then San Diego, it's getting a new terminal.
Yeah, right. Almost ready to open, right?
Yeah, it looks they were doing a tour. They did some tours. They've done some like test days where they test out the terminal to make sure it's, you know, things are working the way they thought and flowing the way they thought. It looks really nice. It has an outdoor terrace that's behind security that everyone can use. Looks nice.
I'm in. Let's go.
I mean, San Diego is kind of the perfect place to have an outdoor terrace for an airport.
Yeah, weather-wise, certainly.
Yeah. This is the terminal that's on the far east side.
Yeah, replaces T1.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be a welcome change from that debacle. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, Spirit was slated to move to it, but then is also stopping service, right? Or someone, Avelo, someone was like supposed to move over, but is also stopping service. I don't remember who now.
Perfect. I can't tell. I'm guessing they will have a way to get from T1 to T2, I think.
The old version, you didn't.
But now it's
inside security, you mean, right?
Yeah, but I guess
the old version you had, it was separate.
Yeah.
That's what I remember. I mean, I'm also thinking back like a long time ago, my recollection is T1 was commuter flights up to LA for the most part, and maybe one or two other airlines that were wholly standalone, right? But so you didn't need to.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think this, it would be cool if you could connect all the way and use the outdoor terrace.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, darn. So is Southwest moving to T1 because they were in the old T1?
I don't know.
Yeah. Cool. Well, it looks really nice. It's like
it does look nice. Yeah, I'm a fan.
A lot of glass, a lot of good views. I think it'll be a nice change. I mean, we've talked about like there hasn't been a new build airport really in the United States. We get these huge terminal rebuilds. We don't get new airports. We just get terminal rebuilds. So I guess we should be happy with what we get.
Yeah, it looks like, and I'm now just looking at the San Diego website, I think they're actually changing like this week.
Oh, is it going to flip over? Oh, nice.
Maybe. Maybe. I don't know.
It's hard to tell.
Hard to tell. First flights arriving the evening of September 22nd. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Also, by the time this airs, the flights will be coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it looks really nice. I think there's, I mean, this is kind of like what airports, I guess, that have been really crowded need to do. It's just hard. Like, it's hard to do when you you have one terminal or like one main head house. Like this is a very hard type of project to do. You can do it here because you have another terminal to put people in.
Yeah. But, and I mean, right, they're going through it at JFK. Any airport, they did it at Heathrow too. Like at any airport, it's, you almost need to sort of make sure you're leaving space available for, new construction, or you need swing space.
Yep.
And that's rarely a good thing, because why are you leaving dead space that you can't, you know, use now?
Yeah.
And so it's really hard for airport operators to do, but then it's sort of, you know, 20 years from now, airport operators' problem, not mine today.
Well, and like places like JFK, I mean, I've heard it's pretty chaotic right now because of all the construction, across multiple terminals. It's very confusing for people. So I don't think it's good necessarily that's what's happening, but it needs to happen. And having the swing space would make it easier, but you have to justify empty space.
Yeah.
So, then there's some data, that we need to talk about. So The Economist has a report that, foreign arrivals to U.S. airports are down almost 4%. I think it's like 3.8 is what they have said.
Yeah.
And we've kind of thought this was the case. I think on the show, we've thought it was what was happening. But now there's some data to back it up. And you did some research and found this the same thing, or close to the same thing?
Yeah, close enough to the same that I assume we're probably working from the same data, which is there's the I-92 form, which is used to be a piece of paper and is now digital, I believe, for most people, that international travelers fill out.
Yep.
And it turns out that there's a random webpage on the trade.gov website that publishes that data, and you can actually select by date. You can select a random geography. So like if I filter just to Canada, you know, Canada's down 8.5% year to date foreign arrivals.
Wow.
But U.S. originating is only down 0.6%.
So Canada's down in general.
Canada's down overall, but it's mostly, you know, the U.S. side has stayed steady. It's the Canadian side that's down.
Yep.
You know, Middle East is a full section on it. You can do like Middle East is actually only down about 3%, but U.S. traffic is up. It's interesting to sort of filter through those. Europe is down 2%, right? While U.S. is up 5%, right? So total traffic is actually up there. It's interesting to sort of look at those. I'm actually a little surprised the U.S. is up that high, considering the complaining U.S. Airlines had about this past summer,
like access to the Middle East.
It's the Europe. How they're complaining about how, especially economy class travel was down, or didn't have the strength they were hoping for. I guess it's just too much capacity. But
yeah.
U.S. traffic to and from Asia is up 13% year to date.
What can you narrow it down by part of Asia?
Sure. If I exclude China, you know, China's actually higher than that, because if I uncheck China, the number goes down. This is the broad version of Asia, right? Everything like Central Asia as well. Yeah. Jeebus. China, U.S. access, U.S. traffic to China is up 30% year over year. 25 to 30%. And inbound is 18 to 19% up.
And that's full year, January 24 to January 25?
It's January through August. Just calendar years, but trying to keep it even.
Okay.
That's a surprisingly high shift. I honestly didn't think there's that much capacity.
Do you think that drops off, though? Do you think it's like people coming back to the United States, or people leaving the United States to go to Asia and not coming back? Well, we won't know that for another year, right? We wouldn't know. Like, we wouldn't be able to compare if those people returned to the U.S., like if they left to go to China.
Well, so it shows both, right? It shows departures and arrivals, and then by U.S. citizen or foreign national.
Yeah.
So more people are arriving and more people are departing.
Okay.
But India down at the same time. India, you know, foreign is down 20%.
So how are we getting to this number that's been posted by The Economist of like 4%?
If you do the full global footprint, it is down 3.8%.
And where is the actual negative coming from? Like what part of the world?
Which parts of the world? Well, China was one.
Okay. Even though year over year it's up, it's still down.
I'm sorry, not China. Canada.
Okay.
Sorry, Canada's down. Africa's down 9%. You know, Asia broadly is on par. We did Canada. Caribbean is down 10%.
Wow, okay.
Central America is down 3%.
So it sounds like kind of touristy type places.
Mexico's down 3%. That's a blended one. Yeah.
Like the Caribbean, surprising. Like it's a little surprising.
I think a lot of it's Canada.
Yeah.
So, right, like the other thing is to look at total numbers. So looking at this chart here, it tells me 38 million is our total number for inbound this year, which is down 4%.
Okay.
Canada is 6.6 million of that. Canada's rough math there is 15%.
Wow.
And it's down 10 and it's down 8.5. So that's a big hit. Europe is 10 million. So it's a quarter and it's down 2%. Mexico's small. I'm surprised. I wonder if this is because this is only air traffic. Mexico is only 4 million.
Yeah. I mean, air traffic, I mean, the border crossings are the big players for Mexico.
The land crossings.
Yeah.
Zero people visiting from North America to the United States.
No, you don't say.
It's because Saint-Pierre and Miquelon is the only country in that category. It's the sort of the pseudo-French exclave off the coast of Nova Scotia.
Is there any way to actually get directly to the United States from there?
No.
Didn't think so.
Yeah, South America's down. But to your point about like the Caribbean being down, it's touristy, but so 6 million, so similar to Canada coming in from the Caribbean. I would argue that it's probably, you know, U.S. numbers in and out are actually up a tiny bit, which is outbound tourism.
Inbound.
VFR. VFR. Yeah, I think it's family visits, and I think that those are people scared to get deported.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, down 4%, like, can this, if this trend continues, especially in those specific places, like Canadian travel to the United States would be down, you know, 12 million people if it was to continue the way it's going. That's significant.
It's bad news for the airlines that are heavily invested in those markets, for sure.
Yeah.
I do think it's kind of interesting looking at the Caribbean numbers. Last month, they're trending back up again. They were down heavily February, March. They spiked in April, which I assume is Easter. And then dropped again in May, but like May, June, July, August, you know, August is only down 3.5% as opposed to, March, which was down 11.3. So it was way worse. So I don't know if that's people are sort of finding some stability in whatever the current policies are or, you know, being slightly less worried, but.
Yeah, I think for me it's worrisome just from the perspective of like the airlines, the hotels and things that are being that have been built up around the specific traffic, right? Like Canadians coming to shop for things, or the Canadians coming to do specific things in like Vegas or whatever, the snowbirds, like that right there is like a whole market that's like disappearing. And we've already heard that like Las Vegas is struggling.
Yeah, I was saying Las Vegas is a really big one. This actually lets you filter on the U.S. side as well. Let me see if I can find Las Vegas.
I think like Las Vegas, Phoenix, San Diego
would
be impacted.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, if I do just Las Vegas, and I do everything from the foreign. Yeah, Las Vegas, only down 5%.
Okay. Well,
But that's arrivals at Las Vegas. I would, you know.
So
that's
connecting traffic.
Yeah, it's not Canada, or it's not connecting. So here's your number. Canadian traffic to Las Vegas is down 20%.
Wow.
Yeah. I was actually talking to someone from there, back at Dorkfest who mentioned how hard that's been to manage, that they're seeing the hurt.
I mean,
and that number, you know, it's interesting. It's those drops are based on it didn't take off right away at the beginning of the year, but after the tariff stuff happened, like, it's clear no one, it's staying on a downward trajectory. It's down 30% for August. No one comes in August anyways, but it's down 30% in August. And so people that had pre-booked trips took them, but no one's booking new.
And it makes you wonder, like, what's going to happen in the winter when snowbirds decide to go somewhere else and they fly over the United States to the Caribbean?
Yeah. And the airlines are putting in schedules to support that. So
yeah. We've talked about that, WestJet and Air Canada.
So yes. Europe to Vegas is actually up a little.
Conferences, you think?
I don't know, but up 15, up not even a little, 13%.
Well, let's talk about Gulf Air. What is Gauss?
Gauss is Martin Gauss, the former CEO of Air Baltic,
okay,
who was no confidence voted out by the board there earlier this year, has landed on his seat at Gulf Air. He's going to be the new CEO.
Wow. That's a big, I mean, I would say it's a step up for him.
Yeah. I mean, it's an airline that runs long haul, right? Like they've got some significant differences in operations, but he's sort of thriving, let's say, or relying on his history of being a turnaround specialist.
I need to learn how to fail upward.
I mean, you're a white male, Steven. It should be easy.
You would think. I was good for him. I mean, Gulf, has Gulf been struggling? I mean, I thought Gulf was kind of just like in a solid spot of carrying a bunch of O&D traffic, some connections.
That's how they positioned themselves, and they've sort of pretended to be pretty proud of that. Or,
yeah.
I don't know if it's pretending, but they positioned themselves as being pretty proud of that. And to be fair, that's sort of what AirBaltic is, right? Like, for a while, AirBaltic did connecting flow through to Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was just serving the Baltics and being pretty good at that. So it's hard to tell. I would argue Gulf Air at least is geographically in a position where connecting flow is theoretically more valuable as you start to get the South Asia to Europe and South Asia to Africa.
Yeah.
Ops. Right. I think what I'll be interested to see is a few things. Gulf Air has historically, you know, it's a relatively small aircraft, 43 planes today, looks like. So 320s and 787s. And it relatively new. Even the 320s are not all Neos, I don't think, but, yeah, they're 50-50 Neo and not, right? So 321s are mostly Neos. So they don't have the problem AirBaltic did of being a bunch of Q400s and 737-500s when Gauss showed up, which were old even then. Right. The 787s are 6.5 years old on average. So, but, right, his play there was unify, single type of fleet, single type of service, get people where they need to be. And that's not, it doesn't seem to me that's going to be the Gulf Air play.
Okay.
Right, you're going to need to keep short haul and long haul, I would imagine. It would be bizarre to me to drop the 787s and go only, you know, regional services. So.
Yeah, I can't see them doing that.
But, you know, it's Bahrain, like, they don't have a huge tourism setup. I want to say they're part of One World.
Gulf, is it Gulf or is it Oman Air?
Maybe I'm thinking of Oman. I might be thinking of Oman Air.
I'll look it up while you're talking.
But yeah, it'll be an interesting one. I don't know a lot of people trying to head to Bahrain.
Yeah. It's Oman Air, not
Gulf. Okay. So then, yeah, I don't know. We'll certainly find out. The other thing to pay attention to is, we have to see if he's still obsessed with NFTs and decides to remake their loyalty program into an NFT program like he did in AirBaltic, which was massively unsuccessful.
I mean, I think the key for Gulf Air is like they are right next to Qatar's, like Doha. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's 100 miles maybe.
Yeah.
And they're really close to Dammam, Saudi Arabia, which it's actually connected by a bridge.
Road.
Like that's a struggle. In and of itself, just you know, how you become a carrier. And I think it's a state carrier, right? Like it's actually
government owned. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of good for him, but also I don't know that I'd want that job.
I mean, AirBaltic was government owned too. They were trying to spin it back out, but yeah, 54 miles to Dammam and 92 miles to Doha. But the bridge to Dammam, I guess your question there is, does that help in terms of people who want to get there, but don't want to connect via Saudi? And also Dammam isn't that major an airport within Saudi Arabia.
No, it's just a huge oil and gas. Like that's what drives traffic to Dammam, is that's where Saudi Aramco has a huge facility. Most of the refinery, most of the oil and gas companies have some sort of facility there.
Yeah.
So
no one's going to fly to, you think no one would fly to Bahrain? Well, I guess the question is, would people fly to Bahrain and commute across if they could get a nonstop?
I think so. I mean, maybe that's the play, is like you look at Europe or you look at even the U.S. If they can get a nonstop from JFK to straight to Bahrain. Yeah, I think people would take it because then it's cuts out Europe. That's what a lot of people do, right? Like they fly to Frankfurt and then they go to Frankfurt to Dammam.
There are actually flights from Dammam to Bahrain.
Seriously?
I got to look that one up. I'm just looking at a map right now. So Baku, no surprise.
Frankfurt.
No, Dammam does not have a nonstop to Frankfurt.
The Frankfurt's gone? Wow. My dad used to take them all the time.
I'm looking at November, but yeah, it's all regional. It's almost all Saudi and then Kuwait. I don't know what MHD is, something up in Iran. Karachi, a couple in Egypt.
Pizan.
Yes, Abu Dhabi. Sorry, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Muscat.
So Lufthansa just must have given up on it.
Yeah, at least for November.
And with COVID and everything, probably added to it. So.
Yeah, but and Bahrain currently. Hang on, I may have a filter. I have a filter on. That's why. That's yeah. Scratch that. Because Bahrain also didn't have it. So Bahrain does have JFK, and then a bunch of flights more broadly, but a lot of that's third party. Yeah. You look just at Gulf Air. Oh, JFK, China, Moscow, all over Europe.
Hmm.
They do a decent stretch. Singapore, Bangkok. But let me pull back up the Dammam, because I bet the Lufthansa is actually there. Frankfurt. Yeah, no, just Amsterdam and Heathrow.
Wow, okay. But still, even that cuts that out, right? If you can fly to... Like if they didn't,
right? Like you connect to GSA, and maybe they show up in Houston. Maybe they bring some of their long haul to other places, right? We've seen airlines pushing further afield, so it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Lastly, there was a video, and there's some articles around this video, but there's a video of an Emirates flight at San Francisco. It was an A380. They were getting ready to push back, and I think the executive order for the H-1B visas had been signed, and people were kind of freaking out a little bit because a lot of that traffic is connecting into Dubai to India, and people were basically demanding to get off the plane because they didn't know what the executive order actually meant. And I don't think we still really know what it means.
They did confirm that existing, they waited. So the executive order is new H-1B visas require $100,000 payment. This is not a deposit. This is not a bond. This is a cash payment. Unless exempted by the government, and it does not apply to existing issued H-1Bs. It applies to new applications. But at the time it was issued, it was unclear whether it applied to new applications, to the point that like Microsoft issued a all hands notice saying, "Do not, if you're an H-1B and you can, please get back to the United States before 12:01 a.m. Eastern on Sunday."
It wasn't just Microsoft. Amazon did it. Like, all the tech companies did it.
I only saw the Microsoft. I'm not surprised. Hey, Foz. Welcome.
Hello.
Foz's connection was a little late, but he got here. Now, we, it is surprising. It's not surprising in a lot of ways, but the whole, we're going to issue an order and not actually explain all the rules and then wait 18 hours to do so was annoying for a lot of people. So, yes, these passengers in India, like, are on their way to India, many of them, justifiably freaked out, where they weren't going to be able to get back and wanted to get off the plane.
Yeah, I mean, I think stressed is an understatement. I think it's like people were, they didn't know what to do. So yeah. they said, I'm just going to get off the plane because if I return to India and this goes into effect and it's going to cost $100,000, my company's just going to let me go.
And could you even get back fast enough?
Yeah.
Well, and so, you know, this went into effect on Friday. The flight's coming out, after like Friday night, Saturday morning out of India, all went through the roof and like everyone was fighting for seats apparently.
Yeah. Like, right. You didn't know.
Yep.
Panna. And it's literally, you know, you've made your life here for several years potentially. And now some of you like, you can't get back. That's not a good spot to be.
No. And I think that when we see the clarifications, it's like, you guys could have just announced that as part of this entire thing, like existing visas aren't affected. Oh, immediately panic goes down. Like, yes. Anyway,
that would have been better.
Cool. Well, that's the show. We have some bonus topics. We're going to talk about Southwest bags experiences, and then Italy's EAS play and some facial recognition issues that they're having. So, we'll talk about that in the bonus topics for our Patreon subscribers. If you're not a Patreon subscriber, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time. Happy travels. Take care.
See you later.